Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Media Roundtable. It has been a terrible week in Syria. UN monitors there say violence has reached unprecedented levels. Human Rights Watch reports that the Syrian intelligence agencies have tortured their opponents in 27 secret detention facilities. And this week, dozens of bombings were claimed by an al-Qaeda-inspired group in the country. Meanwhile, international efforts to change the situation are at an impasse. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton today condemned Russia and China for their unwillingness to back increased pressure on the Syrian government and President Bashar al-Assad. Needless to say, Syria is a difficult and dangerous place to be a reporter. And as we learn more about the forces aiding the Syrian opposition, including Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the CIA, it only gets more complicated. But there are dedicated journalists trying to tell the full story. One of them is Michael Peel, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. He has been reporting from inside Syria recently and now joins us from Abu Dhabi. Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for making time for us.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much. Here in this country, TV news for the past week has been dominated by images of wildfires in Colorado and people suffering through a historic heat wave that has stretched from California to the Carolinas. For environmental activists and climate scientists, it was difficult not to look at these events as part of a larger story about global warming. But according to an analysis by Media Matters, only 3% of the stories on the wildfires and extreme weather of the past week mentioned warming or climate change. So, did news outlets miss out on the big story? Or are there good reasons for journalists and activists to be careful about talking about one week's weather or a particular wildfire in terms of climate change? David Roberts is someone who's thought a lot about those questions. He writes on energy, politics, and more for the environmental news and commentary site Grist. David, great to have you with us.
Great to be here.
And finally, and some good news from Sacramento. On Monday, state lawmakers passed a groundbreaking set of foreclosure relief bills. Later in the hour, we're going to be joined by Denver Post investigative reporter David Magoya, whose award-winning reporting showed how state officials there were actually making it easier for banks to foreclose, even when they didn't have the right to do that. But we will be starting, as we always do, with examples of really good reporting from the week, journalism that was valuable and enlightening. And we invite you to call in at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK with any pieces of journalism, reporting, or analysis from this week you would like to champion and draw people's attention to. As always, we encourage you to be specific, whether it's with praise or criticism, and we will post links to all the reporting discussed in this hour at yourcallradio.org, and that is also where you can find the reporting of Michael Peel, David Roberts, and David Magoya. But let's start with the positive, and Michael Peel, talk to us about a piece of reporting from this week that you were really impressed with.
Well, there was a very interesting piece this week by my colleague Martin Chulov of The Guardian, in which he interviewed a guy who had defected from a TV station in Syria called Adunya TV, which is a private TV station but very pro-regime. And it has indeed become something of a hate figure for the Syrian opposition over its reporting, which they say will do anything to promote the interests of the regime and to discredit the opposition. This defector had some very interesting things to say about the extent to which official regime sources fed into the coverage and indeed directed the coverage of Adunya TV. And it was certainly consistent with what people in Syria have told me, both opposition people but also more independent people who have no time for this TV station. And this is part of the war of the narrative in Syria, really, where, on the one hand, you have these opposition sources who send out a lot of press releases and a lot of information, some of which is true, but some of which is much more dubiously sourced and has turned out to be wrong, whether by accident or design. And then you have regime sources, which, one also has to be very skeptical about for the opposite reasons. And you really see that on the ground as a reporter in Syria, that when I traveled with the UN monitors a couple of months ago in Syria, it's particularly around the town of Bra in the south where the uprising started against the regime. There were lots of state TV, pro-regime TV channel on that tour, but when it came to the monitors going into areas where the opposition was strong and even members of the Free Syrian Army were operating, these guys just couldn't and wouldn't go in because they knew that they were hated in these places and that they would, at worst, people would not talk to them. People would not talk to them, and at worst, they'd get a very hostile reception indeed. So it really showed the way in which Syrian people, and a lot of people talk about this, are really starved of independent, credible information, and that this is one of the big problems, not just for us outside in the international media reporting and trying to make the most of our limited access to Syria, but also for the Syrian people just hungry for information, just facts about the conflict, which are so often disputed and so often thin on the ground.
Yeah, I actually want to get back later, Michael Peel with Financial Times. You've been reporting from Syria, talking about the challenge with, you know, even some of the most important events that have been happening, getting at the simple facts about what has happened in them. So we'll definitely come back to talking about those challenges. I do want to get David Roberts in from Grist. David, tell us, what's a piece of reporting from this week you thought, hey, that was really on target or really well done?
Well, I enjoyed a story done by the Associated Press science reporter named Seth Borenstein a couple of days ago. He did something that tends to be very difficult for kind of day-to-day reporters to do, which is he took a big step back, looked at the weather, the extreme weather and the strange weather of the past year, and called a bunch of climate scientists and tried to get a sense of exactly what this means. Does this mean climate change? Does this not mean climate change? Talked to a bunch and synthesized it really well and avoided a trap that reporters often fall into when they try to do these stories, which is he didn't bother to do that thing down in paragraph 15 where you find the tiny handful of outlier scientists or you know, quasi-scientists who disagree and give them their say, you know, the on the one hand, on the other hand thing. Instead, he just laid out the scientific consensus about this in a very clear and comprehensive way, and he's been one of the only reporters to do that.
So that's Seth Borenstein with the AP. We will post both that story and Martin Chulov's story from The Guardian at yourcallradio.org. Michael Peel with the Financial Times, I want to come back to you and follow up on what you were saying about just how people inside Syria, and I'm sure even as a foreign correspondent, that sense of like, how do I get at the facts of what's happening there? And I actually want to make reference to a blog post from John Williams. He's a BBC foreign editor, and he posted last month, I'm talking about in the aftermath of the massacre and Hula, where the initial reports had said that some of the 49 children and 34 women who were killed there had their throats cut. And subsequently, he said that he learned that Western officials in Damascus said investigations revealed none of that brutality and the killings that happened, but not those particular descriptions that really made global headlines at the time. And meanwhile, you know, just a lot of the details of what had happened were just very hard to get at. What's been your experience trying to report and get at those details of some of these crucial events and how you try to sort these things out? And when you get it wrong, how to try to rectify that?
Well, it is an extremely difficult conflict to report because the conflict is so intense in places, which makes it difficult to get to because access to Syria is so limited. And I think what John Williams is talking about, it cuts both ways, because on the one hand, it's really obviously incumbent on journalists writing on Syria to make sure that we are not misled and we don't report as facts claims of things like what you just mentioned that turn out not to be true, particularly from the opposition. But on the other hand, it's also incumbent on us not to underrepresent things. And it seems fairly clear that there are many bad things going on in Syria involving regime forces and also opposition forces that are really only hinted at and just haven't been reported on properly yet. So there are sins of commission and sins of omission to be very wary of there. And I think the answer is to, as with any other kind of reporting, try and establish facts. If you can't, then look at the competing claims and report them and try and give a reader a sense of which of those may be the more credible. And Hula was an interesting example because there you had something that made headlines around the world, partly because of the descriptions you described, but partly just what is now an established fact, that nobody disputes, neither the regime nor the opposition, that more than 100 people, including many children, were killed there. A horrifying event, whatever happened there, everyone agrees. But one of the interesting things about going to Syria recently, people talking about Hula, was, almost a kind of bemusement from some people saying, well, this wasn't the first time something like this has happened. And I think it's pretty clear that, there have been similar large-scale killings like that in other places. But because UN monitors never visited, there was never any independent outside testimony. Those have never achieved the same status as demonstrable facts to feed into the narrative of the conflict. And I think, when people are able to report more freely, when and if the conflict dies down, there's going to be a lot of backward-looking reporting, going to places where people thought bad things were going on and trying to find out what actually happened. I mean, another example this week has been in Douma, the Damascus suburb, where regime forces have been pounding that place for a couple of weeks now, and reports are that some pretty bad things have happened there. There's activist video of bloodied corpses and people searching for what they say are body parts. We still don't know what's happened there. The regime claims that it only attacks areas to try to dislodge the members of the rebel Free Syrian Army, which it describes as a terrorist group. But there is clearly another example of a story where it's crying out for independent testimony about what happened, and that's clearly a very important job to be done. And there are many, many other cases like that around Syria.
In talking about the narrative of what's happening in Syria, it seems to me, at least in the U.S. media, there's really kind of two stories. One is Assad, his regime, versus the internal opposition, just kind of talking about whatever the kind of biggest battle of the moment is, or the atrocity that, has been reported. And then the second is the international meetings that go on, whether it's the Friends of Syria or the United Nations meeting, where the narrative is primarily the U.S. and the West, and these other nations want to move forward. Russia and China are blocking things. And certainly we could talk some about that. But I'm interested in hearing more about kind of the regional players, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and also the role of the CIA and the U.S. Right now in the region, kind of what their interests are in a certain outcome in Syria.
Well, one thing that is very clear is that there are a lot of competing interests in Syria, that the conflict that's unfolding there is increasingly taking on the characteristics of a proxy international conflict. A lot of Syrians feel that very strongly. And people of quite varied political persuasions, actually. So anti-regime people, some pro-regimers, who feel that Syria has become almost, as one put it, a playground for the international politics of this conflict. On the one hand, you have Syria as an important ally of Russia, probably Russia's most important ally in the Middle East, very important ally of Iran, and also Hezbollah in Lebanon. And on the other hand, you have Western powers who would be very happy to see that connection with Iran broken as part of their wider campaign against Iran, and Gulf states who take a similar position. And that's, of course, incredibly dangerous because it's very hard to see any disinterested brokers in all of this. Turkey, of course, has a 900-kilometer border with Syria, has massive regional interests in the conflict as well, it is a classic case of a country that had quite a good relationship with President Bashar al-Assad's regime, but that has now gone completely sour, and we've seen that in the shooting down of the Turkish jet and the aftermath of that. So really, it's a case where with so many parties, international powers compromised by their own interests. It has to be an organization like the United Nations that takes the lead. The problem, of course, is that we do have this ceasefire. Nominally, we do have this international peace plan drawn up by Kofi Annan, but it's just not being observed on the ground. And the UN monitors now have been grounded for several weeks, unable to go out on patrols because they say it's too dangerous. And it really is, as Mr. Annan has said, incumbent on international powers to break this deadlock and come to some kind of solution to damp down and in the long run find a political solution to a conflict which is causing immense suffering.
Well, what about Israel?
Well, Israel's position is a very interesting one. I mean, I'm not an expert on Israel, but from what I read and what I've spoken to analysts about, the feeling was at the start that Israel had very mixed feelings about this uprising because, on the one hand, Syria was officially a sworn enemy of Israel. Of course, there's the long-standing dispute over the Golan Heights. But on the other hand, the analysts said that there was a feeling in Israeli politics that Mr. Assad was an enemy they could live with because he wasn't aggressive. That border was the most peaceful Israel had. There was a kind of détente of sorts, and that, frankly, that was not something that they had to worry about. And their worry, they were more worried that, if there was some change, that would then be a leadership they couldn't predict or might find politically less palatable sitting across the border from them, and that was something that they would prefer not to see. Now, more recently, for the first time, really, you've started to see some more trenchant statements from the Israeli government condemning the Assad regime. But, you know, it's a sign that the opposition, being diverse as it is, there are varied parts of it, some of which are very attractive to Israel and the West and others, and particularly the Islamist side, somewhat less so.
Michael Peel is a Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. He's been reporting from Syria, is currently in Abu Dhabi. Also with us on today's Your Call Media Roundtable is David Roberts with Grist Magazine. Actually, Michael Peel is going to be with us for just a few more minutes, so if you have questions or comments about coverage of Syria or other matters in the Middle East, you're welcome to call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And David Roberts, I'm going to go to a call now, but if you have any questions for Michael Peel, welcome to have you join with us as well. But let's go to Alex in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Wonderful program, as always. I think the American concern, quote-unquote, for the Arabs in Syria is just another one of those crocodile tears. If they were concerned for the Arabs, they would have done something about the plight of the Palestinian people. When Israel massacres Palestinians, Nazi style, all you get out of the State Department, the United States government, is we regret that, regretting for over 50 years. Now,
Alex, yeah, I think the point's clear. Can we get? I'm going to get Michael Peel to respond about what you see as the double standard. So, Michael Peel, double standard in the U.S. response to government crackdowns, depending on who they're by in the Middle East.
Well, that's certainly one criticism that has been made, and there's clearly an important debate to be had there. And you know, this is obviously a theme throughout the Arab Spring, and indeed in any Western policy anywhere, that the allegation that the West picks and chooses its battles according to the outcomes it wants to see, and that's clearly an important debate to have. On the other hand, I would say don't lose sight of the fact that whatever the power interests that are available, there clearly is very powerful testimony and evidence that the Syrian regime has, or members of it and the armed forces have committed or deserve to be investigated for serious human rights abuses. We've seen some of the bombardments of residential areas and people saying that, you know, that's on the face of it looks like a potential war crime, and there are many, many other reports. the opposition to, the increasing number of reports about atrocities involving them, they also need to be investigated and held to account for that. And the point is that, wherever abuses are committed and by whoever, to be held accountable, preferably by international independent bodies.
David Roberts, we're going to have to let Michael Peel go in a moment. I know you're probably just like anyone else following what's going on in Syria. Do you have any questions for him there in Abu Dhabi?
No, this has been quite educational. I know very little about Syria, and I've been enjoying this.
Well, I want to get Michael, before we have to let you go, yesterday there was a big trove of documents that WikiLeaks started to release, emails from the Syrian government, from officials, from ministries, also from opposition forces. Those are just starting to come out. Wanting to know if you've seen anything in those or heard anything about those that you find particularly interesting, and whether you have any questions about the timing of this release.
Yeah, so far, I've been out today and doing other things, so I haven't seen if there'd been more released today. But the emails I saw released yesterday, it was a very small cache, and it seemed to relate to some kind of deal to provide communications equipment to the Syrian regime by an Italian company and a Greek company. It looked interesting, but not perhaps an earth-shattering disclosure, but they say that they have an awful lot of emails. There may well be a lot more to come, and given previous email leaks we've seen in this uprising, particularly those from President Bashar al-Assad's account and that of his wife, there could be some pretty interesting stuff. So I think people will be watching closely, and also some people perhaps who feel that they may have been the authors of some of those emails will be feeling a little bit nervous right now.
Michael Peel, thanks so much for your reporting that you have been bringing. So what's your next step? What are you reporting on now? What have you been out working on?
Well, trying to continue on Syria and to make the most of the limited access we have, and to report, continue reporting from outside of the country, which of course is always unsatisfactory and always difficult, but particularly so in the case of Syria for the reasons we've discussed. But unfortunately, this looks like it's going to go on for a long time, and we have to do our best to bring news of it as we can.
Well, Michael Peel with the Financial Times, thank you so much for joining us from Abu Dhabi. Michael Peel is Middle East correspondent for FT, and he is in Abu Dhabi now, but has been recently reporting from Syria. Also on the line today on our Your Call Media Roundtable is David Roberts. He writes about energy, politics, and more for grist.org. That is an environmental website. A lot of great reporting and commentary there at grist.org. And you can find all the journalism that we're talking about on today's Your Call Media Roundtable at yourcallradio.org. You can also leave comments and questions there, which we're happy to read on the air. And also you can join the conversation at 866-798-8255. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We're going to be going to a break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about the wildfires in Colorado and also the heat wave across the United States, and the way those momentary crises, this crisis of this moment, have or have not been covered in terms of the long-term crisis of global warming. And I'm interested to hear what kind of reporting you have seen or watched that you thought really made that connection in a valuable way. And also, if you're someone who is concerned about global warming, do you sometimes worry that when there's, a connection to a particular moment of weather or a particular disaster like the wildfires in Colorado or throughout the West, that could go back the other direction if the circumstances change? The number to call is 866-798-8255, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, San Francisco. We have a free email newsletter. Join more than 7,000 of your fellow listeners who get an email every week or two that keeps them aware of the diverse programming on local public radio, as well as opportunities to participate in station events. To join, just click the email newsletter link on the front page of kalw.org. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco. Thank you.
This is Your Call, and I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who'll be back on Monday. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our email newsletter to keep up with what's coming up next. Speaking of which, on Monday, Rose is going to be talking about sleep and whether it is a public health issue. What happens when we don't get sleep? What effect does it not just have on us as individuals, but as a society? Could we be a more sleep-friendly society? And on Tuesday, we're going to be talking about Germany's commitment to wind and solar energy and how a state like California could follow suit. That's coming up on Monday on Your Call. Today, we're talking about the week's journalism. Said goodbye to Michael Peel of the Financial Times. With us now is David Roberts with grist.org. And joining us in a moment with David Magoya from the Denver Post. David Roberts reports for Grist, which is an environmental reporting and analysis website. And David, you wrote recently about an issue I think that's been on a lot of minds of people who are watching the fires in Colorado, also seeing the heat wave across the country, and asking themselves, you know, is this caused by global warming? And when it comes to the wildfires, at least you said this is a question that kind of drives me crazy. But on the other hand, you dug into it. Talk about how you respond to that question.
Right. Well, I think the way to understand it is that it's just not quite the right question to ask. So by analogy, think about it this way. Think about a baseball player taking steroids. So he'll hit more home runs, but if he goes up and hits a home run, it's not really right to say the steroids caused that home run. You know, for any given home run, what caused it was his hand-eye coordination or the nature of the pitch or, you know, something more immediate and proximate like that. What you're saying when you're saying he's taking steroids is home runs will happen more often. And it would also be odd to say, if he goes up and strikes out, to say, see, there's no steroids. The point being, it's not going to, you know, there's not going to be a home run every time, just that home runs become more frequent. So the word cause, it causes a lot of trouble here. I think our sort of folk understanding of the word cause doesn't quite fit with the facts here. The point is that climate change is changing the odds of wildfires, and it's changing the nature of wildfires when they happen.
Well, so I guess for myself, you know, sitting watching the evening news this past weekend, you know, every night, that was the lead story showing the fires that were happening in Colorado, the destruction being caused, various officials coming there. And, you know, I couldn't help but think, well, where is some kind of mention of global warming? But how, you know, what do you think the right way for journalists to bring that into the story is? And also, I mean, isn't there the risk of some kind of backlash of going, okay, you're being opportunistic, now that's being mentioned, but, you know, the people who are either on the fence or who are deniers of climate change going, well, hey, you don't say that during the cold snap.
Right. Well, I don't think there's a really good answer to that question yet. And I think that explains why you see so many journalists shying away from it. It's a really, you know, it's an interesting contrast to the Syria story that we were just talking about. In Syria, it's the facts themselves that are difficult to get out, literally physically difficult to get at. But here, the facts are out, the facts are clear enough, but the difficulty is how exactly to talk about them, how to phrase about them, what's the right tone, what's the right language, and I think reporters get nervous about those kind of questions and are more likely to just avoid them. So, I mean, well, and what you said about opportunism is on everyone's mind. Like, for instance, the other day I saw a story about the wildfires that made hay of the fact that the firefighters in the West right now don't have health insurance, which is on the one hand true, but on the other hand, it's hard not to see that and think, you're kind of using a tragedy to make an unrelated point, you know, and people, I think, resent that. And that's the danger, I think, with climate change, too, is that readers are going to be turned off by you know, the idea that, in a sense, you're using people's suffering to make a point. So the question is how to relate it so that it's part of the story and not just tacked on. And I don't know that anybody knows quite how to do that yet. But I mean, the fact is, climate change is changing the normal parameters of weather so that extremes happen more often. It's going to get, you know, and I think the signal, the climate change signal in the weather noise, is going to be much, much clearer later this century. That's something that every climate change scientist agrees on. We're not going to be having these sort of semantic debates in 20, 30 years. It will be much clearer. But right now, it's sort of the climate change signal is faint, and there's some debate about whether you can pick it out of the noise. So, and those kind of, you know, sort of complex questions about incremental problems, about signals amidst noise, that kind of thing is very difficult to summarize and deliver in a snappy 2 or 3 second soundbite.
Well, David, I want to actually turn to our listeners to see what they think about this. Certainly, anybody who's had the news on or read the newspaper has been following the heat wave and wildfire coverage of the last week. What do you think the right way for journalists to approach this is? Did you find somebody who managed to make the connection between these specific events and the broader trends of global warming and climate change in a way that you thought was meaningful or taught you something? The number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Can you talk about extreme weather in terms of global warming, and what's the best way to do it? You can also email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And David Roberts, I actually want to bring in another guest, David Magoya of the Denver Post. He's an investigations and personal finance reporter at the business desk there, and he's done some award-winning reporting on Colorado's foreclosure system, which, David Magoya, I definitely want to get to talk to you about that. But I'm interested listening in from Denver to what David Roberts has to say here, kind of what the conversation is there in Colorado. Are people thinking, you know, beyond obviously the crisis of the moment, which is plenty to attend to, but how this might fit into a larger long-term story?
You know, I think a lot of the folks here are just paying more attention way the winds are blowing.
Yeah.
as you could figure. I think David has some very valid points. I don't necessarily ascribe to some of the thinking. I'm at 30 years in the business, I can't conceive of being a reporter who's afraid to ask of a question. I think what we're afraid to hear sometimes are the answers, because they become much more complex and a little more difficult to get to the root of an answer that seems to answer it effectively. And that's a big problem. But the way the fires have been here, we've got a bunch. What you're hearing about are the ones that were destroying homes, sadly, down in the Colorado Springs area. But we've got others up north near Fort Collins that are much more destructive, a lot larger, and causing many more problems. But, you know, as the TV cameras go, it's the ones with the best sound and visual bite for the moment on the Internet, and those are the ones that get everybody's attention. So that's what you're seeing mostly, are the smaller but more destructive ones.
But this is also opportunity. I mean, just talking about the wildfires, and this isn't just a story about the environment. It's a story about land use. It's a story about choices in real estate development. And actually, some of your colleagues at the Denver Post talked about how more and more Coloradans are living in these red zones, places where wildfires are much more likely to happen. It seems like that's some really valuable context that I'm sure that reporting is going to continue after the crisis has passed.
Oh, absolutely. And these aren't new stories. I mean, when we had the largest and most destructive fire at the time in Colorado's history, the Hayman Fire, that was started by a U.S. Forest Service employee, those very same questions came up. There was award-winning work done by us and the other newspaper in town that had been, the Rocky Mountain News, specifically on the thinning of the forests or fire prevention and how folks are living in hot zones and what type of protections they ought to be afforded and tax issues and payment issues. I mean, this is an ongoing debate. Arizona had the very same thing, as I recollect, about 4 or 5 years ago with the number of catastrophic fires there. I mean, wildfires are a fact of nature. They pretty much are. How destructive they become is a fact of how we live and where we put ourselves.
Well, we've got a number of callers who want to talk about this issue and how it's being covered. I want to first go to Aaron in Oakland. Aaron, thanks so much for calling your call.
Yeah, thanks. Good morning. I want to recommend a blog, and it's called Climate Progress, that is an incredibly comprehensive blog covering all aspects of the climate change issue in question. And they cover the relationship to extreme weather very regularly. And, for example, you know, it's really been dramatically convincing to me the way cold temperature records and hot temperature records used to be fairly balanced one-to-one in the course of a year or even a decade. But that has been really changing. And the ratio of hot temperature records broken has been much higher in relation to cold weather records. And so the trend is really sort of dramatic and scary. And so I just want to recommend that blog.
David Roberts at Grist, are you familiar with Climate Progress?
Oh, yes, very familiar. That's run by Joe Rome, a friend of mine. He is fantastic, and I echo that recommendation.
You know, speaking of the relationship between global warming and extreme weather, there was a report from the IPCC, the Nobel Prize-winning panel on climate change, talking about the relationship between those two. And actually, it was interesting seeing Joe Rome and also Andrew Revkin from the New York Times back in March when this report came out, really debating about what the report said and whether it made clear enough the connection between those two. I don't know if that's something you followed or you could weigh in on.
Well, this is an unfortunate characteristic of IPCC reports, which is they get, you know, hundreds of scientists, and not just scientists, but also politicals and other people, and they all have to sign off on a single document. And if you've ever been part of a process like that, you'll know that the outcome tends to be somewhat opaque and hedged and complicated, and it's not the kind of thing that I think is particularly useful for handing over to the public. And exactly how to distill those insights is a matter of judgment, and that's what Joe and Andy have argued about many times in the past, and again over that report.
Well, I want to bring on Kevin, who's called in from Felton. Kevin, welcome to your call.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Something about this discussion that's always troubled me is the misuse of the word belief. In other words, do you believe in climate change? And it's obvious climate change is a scientific question. It's about objective fact and the evaluation of fact and evidence. It's not about whether you believe in something as though someone believes in a moral code or a religious belief. And I think the misuse of those terms confuses people about the massive accumulated evidence that climate change is in fact real and not a question of whether you believe in it or not. That's my comment. Thank you.
David Roberts, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. You know, George Orwell used to talk about dead metaphors, which is a metaphor or analogy that we've been using so long that we don't even think of it as a metaphor or an analogy anymore. We just say it literally. And in a similar sense, a lot of what turns up as facts in news stories, you might call dead theories. They were once contested scientific theories and once had to be called out as such, but have been so well confirmed over time that now they're just reported, frankly, as fact. And climate change in mainstream reporting has not yet made that jump. Reporters are still too nervous just to say, you know, plainly, climate change's effects are visible yet again in the wildfires, blah, blah, blah. They still feel the need to hedge and include disclaimers and do the one hand on the other hand reporting. So I do think that transition, almost a cognitive transition, hasn't happened yet, and that's an important signal that the message is getting through.
And I will say that Joe Rome, the Climate Progress blog, is a great place if you just want to build up your knowledge in that sense, like, oh, I'm not just taking this on, you know, I'm not just making an assumption about this. I can go and dig in about these particular controversies around global warming and the different evidence, how they're linked to extreme weather or other effects. I think it is a great source for that. I do definitely want, because we're running a little low on time, I want to invite callers at 866-798-8255 to join us here on the Your Call Media Roundtable. We are talking about the wildfires in Colorado and elsewhere in the West, and also the heat wave across the country. How do you think it ought to be covered? How do you think global warming should be brought into the coverage and into the popular discussion of these issues? With us is David Roberts from Grist.org. Also on the line from Denver is David Magoya. He's an investigative reporter, a business journalist for the Denver Post there. And we were interested in his reporting because this week California passed a homeowner's bill of rights that specifically put some protections in place for homeowners to slow foreclosures, particularly in situations where a bank is both pursuing foreclosure and pursuing a loan modification with the same homeowner at the same time. And so that has been passed by the legislature here in California, awaiting Governor Jerry Brown's signature. But we were interested in David Magoya's reporting for the Denver Post, where he really dug into the foreclosure process in Colorado and found some, I think to a lot of people, some pretty surprising things. David, this has been award-winning coverage and has had some impact on policy discussions since. Tell us about how you got into this story and what you learned.
You know, it's a lot of times we get into the stories simply by accident. I've been, as I mentioned earlier on your show, that I've been at this for about 30 years. So you sort of get a premise that you like to start from, and mine's always, you know, how does a system work? Before you can actually criticize or critique or analyze the system, you have to understand how it's supposed to work in the first place. And when I was asked to take a look at Colorado's public trustee system, ours is a little unique, very unique in the nation, in that we have appointed public trustees by the governor, and their job is to oversee the entire foreclosure process. So in looking at that, the very first story we found, we had heard when homes are being put on the auction block, being sold for foreclosure, that oftentimes they will sell for a price that's more than what the homeowner owes on that home. Now, if you're like most people, as I was, the concept is you lose your home in a foreclosure, you're done. You walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose your home, and that's the end of that. Well, it's actually not quite like that. In fact, if you owe, let's say, $100,000 on a home, it goes to auction in the foreclosure sale and obtains $150,000. Theoretically, after all liens are paid and any other claims, whatever's left above that $100,000 goes to you, the homeowner. It makes perfect sense in the logical concept, but it wasn't something that I had thought of. So when we bumped into this and saw that, in fact, there are many homes that were being sold in this foreclosure crisis for much more money than what was owed, the question then became, so what happens to this money? Well, it's supposed to go to these homeowners, but we can't find them. So we started unraveling that system and finding out that the counties are supposed to look for these folks, don't. And then after a five-year effort, if they don't find anybody, they get to keep the money. Now, what government is going to take a great deal of effort to find you and give you your money back? Tell me. So,
especially in the current fiscal climate, right? They're looking for every penny.
That's sort of what started unraveling. I said, well, all right, if this is going on, let's take a look at the whole thing. So rather than write stories that took a look at the foreclosure of homes and the efforts by individuals to keep their home, which robo-signing, all that effort that was going on one side of the equation, we decided to dismantle the process and take a look at it forensically on the other side. How is the government dealing with this? And we just found a litany of issues going down to the core of, well, public trustees are supposed to be impartial intermediaries in the foreclosure process. But we found, in fact, that they had very many under-the-table relationships, contractual relationships with the attorneys, the foreclosure attorneys they're supposed to oversee in the first place, taking contributions in organizations they created to help trustees know how to do their job better. We're taking money from these attorneys. Just a whole bunch of problems. So that's kind of where we got to, thankfully a number of legislators stepped up, passed legislation to fix some of these issues. One of the initiatives, which was to fix a very chronic problem, which is essentially in Colorado, by law, these attorneys all help pass these laws. One does not actually have to prove they have the right to foreclose in order to foreclose in Colorado. You would think that
doesn't somebody have to show the documentation there?
They don't. Colorado came up with a law around 2006 and later perfected in 2009, which essentially is called a statement of qualified holder. It's an attorney who is retained by a lender or a bank. And their job is to go forward with the foreclosure process. Rather than show the actual loan documents, the lawyers, through a statement, neither sworn statement nor certified statement, but a statement that says, my guy, my client, the bank, is the right guy. That's it. And that's all it needed.
And so what's happened with the, there's been a real change in the way these things happen in Colorado now, in part in result of the reporting that you did?
Yes, and in fact, there was a great effort to pass legislatively to prevent this statement of qualified holder from continuing. That failed in a committee on party lines. We sort of dismantled what was behind that, and then they're moved forward with a grassroots effort to get it on the ballot to make it a constitutional amendment. That's actually been succeeding and made it all the way through the state Supreme Court. and at the moment still qualifies to appear on the ballot in November.
Wow.
To prevent that from happening.
Well, I mean, obviously, states across the country, I mean, there's a kind of a nationwide lawsuit that was brought on behalf of a bunch of states towards mortgage lenders, as well as these things happening on the state level. I mean, here in California, this Homeowners Bill of Rights that was passed by the legislature earlier this week specifically targets this practice of dual tracking, where the lenders is that kind of thing happening in Colorado?
Colorado doesn't seem to have that very same issue, although the type of issue does exist. And in fact, you can see where it is a problem, where a homeowner is making modification work on one side of the equation, yet on the other side of the equation, they're getting served with foreclosure papers. What happens here is they put these foreclosures in abeyance, and they allow them to sit there, active, and can be turned on just like a light switch at any time. So typically what happens is it stays quiet, and then when this modification, the mod either fails or can't seem to get through, then that light switch goes on. So rather than this 30, 60-day period you might have at the beginning of a foreclosure, they start anew, and the time just acts as if it hadn't even stopped before.
So now that you've really dug into the foreclosure system in Colorado specifically, the problems, say some of them are quite unique to that state.
Yeah.
When you look at the kind of national coverage of foreclosure, what different perspective does it give you on it?
One of the things that we didn't seem to have a big issue with was the robo-signing concept. That had been going on mostly in Florida, I believe Nevada, Arizona to some degree, I think in California, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yeah.
And this was just the churning of documents through foreclosure mills, largely through the representation of the banks, their law firms. Colorado's a little bit different. So the robo-signing wasn't happening because the paperwork was being done by the actual attorney themselves that was going to court. So there wasn't this individual, I don't know, Sally Smith, to create a name, who's the vice president of whatever, when she's actually a phone operator and sits there signing, you know, a name several hundreds of thousands of times. That didn't happen in Colorado. What did happen that's a little bit different is that these documents, we are not a judicial foreclosure state. In other words, the public trustee is where foreclosures occur through our process. It doesn't go to a court. However, there is a small piece of ours that does go to court. It's called the Rule 120 hearing, that based on the statute that it's created by. Essentially, you can't sell these homes without a judge's signature. And the judge has the opportunity to hear a case from a homeowner. Most homeowners don't find out about these Rule 120s until very late in the game, don't understand by law they're required to make a document filing. Most of them think they just show up to court, like a traffic ticket. Sadly, they have no right to present any of their case there. In fact, the judge is only listening for two things. Are you a member of the military, which would disqualify the foreclosure, and are you, in fact, in arrears on your note? Is the loan in default? That's it. So essentially what it's created is a robo-signing, for want of a better way to describe it, foreclosure sales in Colorado. The judges never actually see any of these documents. They don't actually sign anything. It's all electronic, but the amount of money that goes into it is astonishing.
So we are coming near to the end of a program here on Your Call, our media roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who will be back on Monday. You've just been listening to David Magoya. He's an investigations and personal finance reporter for the business desk at the Denver Post, talking about his award-winning reporting on Colorado's foreclosure system. Also on the line with us from Seattle is David Roberts. He's staff writer for grist.org, covers energy and climate change for that environmental analysis and information website. David, I wanted to come back to you. As you're looking forward, what are you reporting? You've had a really interesting series of interviews with Michael Liebrich, the head of Bloomberg New Energy Finance, which I'd recommend to folks. Talk about why you decided to do that.
Well, one of the things that's been, in my experience, after about 10 years covering this area, one of the things that's been lacking is sort of non-aligned actors. You can find a lot of people in NGOs and environmental advocacy groups who are you know, smart people, but have a very distinct perspective. And there are people in industry groups, and there are people who don't know much. And Michael, as a head of this research and finance group, is one of the few people who has a really comprehensive view of the clean energy landscape, but also it isn't sort of playing for any team. So he has a very sort of dispassionate and an interesting take on development.
So he's giving advice to potential investors.
Yeah, well, he does. They do research for investors, basically research market trends and things like that. So he's got his finger on the pulse of, you know, the solar market and natural gas fracking and all that kind of stuff.
No, it's really, really fascinating perspective and just incredible range of stuff that you all cover in those conversations.
Yeah, I felt like we just got started.
Anything you particularly surprised you that you talked to Michael Liebrich about?
One of the interesting things we talked about is coal in China. You know, if you talk to environmentalists, everybody's very depressed about the fact that no matter how much we sort of suppress coal use here in the U.S., coal demand is skyrocketing in China and India as they develop. And I asked him about that, and he said, well, it might not be as bad as all that. I think that sort of wave has crested. I don't think we're ever going to see, again, another area of the world that big grow that fast based on coal. So it was actually, in a sense, less pessimistic than the story I usually hear, which is not something I usually run across in my line of work.
And I just got good news from our producer that on our program we're doing on Tuesday, we were talking about Germany's push forward with wind and solar and talking about what lessons it might have for us here in California. We're going to have Michael Liebrich as a guest. So that's
great. Folks, that's a great story. Germany's example is really fascinating. I'll have to listen in on that.
Well, David Roberts with Grist, thanks so much for joining us. You can read David Roberts' reporting at grist.org. And also joining us this hour, David Morgoia, investigations and personal finance reporter for the business desk at the Denver Post. David, thank you so much for your reporting and for joining us on Your Call today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm Matt Martin, and I've been sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who is going to be back at the beginning of next week. I hope you all stay tuned. I want to thank everyone who called or emailed during the hour, and stay tuned. Just a moment, I'll let you know what is coming up on Monday. Is lack of sleep a public health issue? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the critical importance of sleep to our mental and physical health. According to the National Sleep Foundation, at least 40 million Americans suffer from sleep disorders. How much sleep do we need? What effect does sleep or the lack of it have on our bodies? And how could we create a more sleep-friendly society? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, as the nation celebrates independence and freedom, we'll examine whether our civil liberties and freedoms are indeed under attack today. Also, actor LeVar Burton brings TV's Reading Rainbow to the digital age, and singer Chaka Khan opens up about her music and her work to help at-risk youth on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show coming up at noon, followed by Smiley and West at 1 o'clock, right here on your local public radio station, KALW, San Francisco. Coming up next, we take you to the World Service of the British Broadcasting Corporation for the BBC's World Have Your Say on KALW, San Francisco. The time is 10 o'clock.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. Ben James here with you on the BBC's Global Conversation.
The Syrian people will remember the choices you make in the coming days, and so will the world.
What sort of friends does Syria need? The hashtag Friends of Syria has been one of the top trends on Twitter all day as representatives of more than 100 countries gathered, this time in Paris, in another discussion about how to stop the violence. Russia and China were notable absentees. Are countries which consider themselves to be Syria's friends doing a good job? We've got a group of Syrians coming up to discuss that. You can post your questions and comments for them at facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay. Also, should actors in adult films be obliged to wear condoms? There's going to be a vote in LA on a proposed new law. What do you think?